Simon & Schuster Audio presents The It Girl by Ruth Ware. Read by Imogen Church. Before. Afterwards, it was the door she would remember. It was open, she kept saying to the police. I should have known something was wrong. She could have retraced every step of the walk back from the hall. The gravel crunching beneath her feet of the path across Old Quad, under the Charwell Arch. Then the illegal shortcut through the darkness of the fellow's garden, her feet light on the dew-soaked forbidden lawn. Oxford didn't need keep-off-the-grass signs. That lawn had been the preserve of dons and fellows for more than 200 years, without needing to remind undergraduates of the fact. Next, past the master's lodgings, and along the path that skirted round the new quad, close on 400 years old, but still 100 years younger than the old quad. Then, up staircase 7. 4 flights of worn stone steps, right up to the top, where she and April slept. On the left-hand side of the landing, opposite Dr. Myers's rooms. Dr. Myers's door was closed, as it always was, but the other door, her door, was open. That was the last thing she remembered. She should have known something was wrong, but she suspected nothing at all. She knew what happened next, only from what the others told her. Her screams, Hugh following her up the stairs 2 at a time, April's limp body sprawled across the hearthrug in front of the fire, almost theatrically in the photos she was shown afterwards. But she could not remember it herself. It was as if her brain had blocked it out, shut down, like a memory glitch on a computer file. File corrupted. And no amount of patient questioning from the police ever brought her closer to that actual moment of recognition. Only sometimes, in the middle of the night, she wakes up with a picture in front of her eyes, a picture different from the grainy Polaroids of the police photographer, with their careful evidence markers and harsh floodlit lighting. In this picture, the lamps are dim, and April's cheeks are still flushed with the last glimpse of life. And she sees herself running across the room, tripping over the rug to fall on her knees beside April's body. And then she hears the screams. She is never sure if that picture is a memory or a nightmare, or perhaps a mix of both. But whatever the truth, April is gone. After. £17.98, Hannah says to the woman standing in front of her, who nods without really paying attention and pushes her credit card across the counter. Contactless, okay? The woman doesn't answer immediately. She's trying to get her 4-year-old to stop playing with the rubbers in the stationery display. But when Hannah repeats the question, she says, Oh, sure. Hannah holds the card against the machine until it beeps, and then hands the books across the counter along with the receipt. The Gruffalo, The New Baby, and There's a House Inside My Mummy. Baby brother or sister on the way. She catches the eye of the little girl playing with the stationery and gives her a conspiratorial smile. The girl stops in her tracks and then all of a sudden she smiles back. Hannah wants to ask her her name, but is aware that might be overstepping the line. Instead, she turns back to the customer. Would you like a bag? Or we have these gorgeous totes for £2. She gestures behind the counter at the stack of canvas bags, each stencilled with the pretty Tall Tales logo, a teetering stack of books spelling out the shop's name. No thanks, the woman says shortly. She stuffs the books into her shoulder bag, and grabbing her daughter's hand, she pulls her out of the shop. A penguin-shaped rubber tumbles to the floor as they go. Stop it! Hannah hears her say as they pass through the Victorian glass doors, setting the bell jangling. I have had just about enough of you today. Hannah watches them disappear up the street, the little girl wailing now, hanging from her mother's grip, and her hand goes to her belly. Just the shape of it is reassuring, hard and round, and strangely alien, like she swallowed a football. The books in the parenting section use food metaphors. A peanut, a plum, a lemon.
This is like the very hungry caterpillar of parenting, Will said, mystified when he read the first trimester chapter.
This week's was a mango, if she remembers right, or maybe a pomegranate. Will brought her an avocado when she got to 16 weeks as a kind of jokey present to mark the milestone, bringing it up to her in bed, cut in half with a spoon. Hannah only stared down at it, feeling the morning sickness that was supposed to have stopped coil and roll in her gut. And then she pushed the plate away and ran to the loo. I'm sorry, she told Will when she got back. It was a lovely thought. It was just... she couldn't finish. Even thinking about it made her nauseous. It wasn't just the smooth oiliness of it against her tongue. It was something else, something more visceral. The idea of eating her own baby. Coffee? Robin's voice cuts through her thoughts, and Hannah turns to where her colleague is standing at the other end of the counter. Sorry?
I said, do you want a coffee, or are you still off it?
No, I'm back on. I'm just trying not to overdo it. Maybe a decaf, if that's okay. Robin nods and disappears up the other end of the shop, into the glorified cupboard they call the staff room. And almost exactly as she goes out of sight, Hannah's phone vibrates in the back pocket of her jeans. She keeps it on silent at work. Kathy, the owner of Tall Tales, is nice, and checking phones isn't forbidden, but it's distracting to have it going off during story time or while she's helping a customer. Now, though, the shop is empty, and she pulls it out to see who's calling. It's her mother. Hannah frowns. This isn't usual. Jill isn't one for random calls. They speak about once a week, usually on Sunday mornings after her mother comes back from her swim at the lake. Jill rarely calls midweek and never during the working day. Hannah picks up.
Hannah,
her mum says straight away without preamble.
Can you talk?
Well, I'm at work, so I'll have to go if a customer comes in, but I can chat quickly. Has something happened?
Yes. No, I mean...
Her mother stops. Hannah feels alarm begin to creep over her. Her efficient, prepossessed mother never lost for words. What can have happened? Are you okay? It's not... you're not ill?
No!
She hears the short, relieved bark of laughter that accompanies the word, but there is still that odd tension underneath.
No, nothing like that. It's just that... well, I take it you haven't seen the news.
What news? I've been at work all day.
News about... John Neville.
Hannah's stomach drops. The sick nurse has been slowly getting better for the last few weeks. Now, with a lurch, the nausea is back. She clamps her mouth shut, breathing hard through her nose, holding on to the shop counter with her free hand, as if it can anchor her.
I'm sorry,
her mother says into the silence.
I didn't want to ambush you at work, but it just came up on my Google alerts and I was worried someone from Pelham would call you or you'd get doorstepped by the mail. I thought...
Hannah hears her swallow.
I thought it would be better having it come from me.
What? Hannah's jaw is clenched as if that can stop the sickness, and she swallows back the water suddenly pooling behind her teeth. Have what come from you?
He's dead.
Oh. It's the strangest feeling. A rush of relief and then a kind of hollowness. How?
Heart attack in prison.
Jill's voice is gentle, as if she is trying to soften the news. Oh, Hannah says again. She gropes her way to the stool behind the counter, the one they use for quiet periods, stickering the books. She puts her hand over her stomach as if protecting herself from a blow that's already landed. The words do not come. The only thing she can do is repeat herself. Oh.
Are you okay?
Yes, sure. Hannah's voice sounds flat in her own ears, and as if it's coming from a long way off. Yes, why wouldn't I be?
Well?
She can tell her mother is choosing her words carefully.
It's a big thing. A milestone.
A milestone. Maybe it's that word coming out of her mother's mouth just after she was recalling her conversation with Will, but suddenly she cannot do this anymore. She fights the urge to sob, to run, to leave the shop in the middle of her shift. I'm sorry, she mutters into the phone. I'm really sorry, Mum, I've got to. She can't think what to say. I've got a customer, she manages at last. She hangs up. The silence of the empty shop closes around her. Before. The parking spaces on Pelham Street were overflowing, so Hannah's mother paused on a double yellow line on the high street while Hannah scrambled out with the larger of her cases and her mother's promise to come and find her when she'd parked the car. As Hannah stood there, watching the beat-up Minnie drive away, she had the strangest feeling, as though, in stepping out of the car, she had sloughed off her old identity like a second skin, leaving a sharper, fresher, less worn version of herself to face the world, a version prickling with newness. As she turned around to gaze up at the crest above the carved stone arch, she felt the cool October wind lift her hair and brush against the back of her neck, and she shivered with a heady mix of nerves and excitement. This was it. The culmination of all her hopes, dreams, and meticulously plotted revision strategies. One of the oldest and most prestigious of colleges, in one of the oldest and most prestigious centres of learning in all the world. Oxford University's famous Pelham College. And now, her new home for the next 3 years. The huge oak door in front of her was open, unlike on the day she had come for her interview when she'd had to knock at the medieval grilled door within a door, waiting for the porter to peer out at her like something out of Monty Python. Now she dragged her case through the arched passage, past the porter's lodge, to a table under a gazebo, where older students were handing out folders of information and directing freshers. "Hi," Hannah said as she drew closer, her case grinding on a gravelled path. "Hi, my name's Hannah Jones. Can you tell me where I should go?" "Of course," the girl behind the table said brightly. She had long, shiny blonde hair and her accent was crisp as cut glass. "Welcome to Pelham. So, you'll need to get your keys and accommodation details from the porter's lodge, first of all." She pointed back at the arch Hannah had just passed through. "Have you got your bod card yet? You'll need that for pretty much everything, from paying for meals through to checking out library books." Hannah shook her head. "No, but I've registered for it." "So you pick it up from Cloisters too, but you can do that any time today. You probably want to drop your case off first. Oh, and don't forget the freshers' fair and the new joiners' meet and greet." She held out a sheaf of flyers, and Hannah took them, awkwardly holding the slippery papers under her free arm. "Thanks," Hannah said, and then, because there didn't seem to be much else to say, she turned and dragged her case back the way she had come, to the porter's lodge. She hadn't been inside the lodge on the day of her interview. The porter had come out to let her in, and now she saw that it was a little wood-panelled room, almost like a post office, with two windows overlooking the quad and the arched entrance passageway, a counter and rows of pigeonholes neatly marked with names. The thought that one of them was presumably hers gave her a curious feeling, a kind of belonging. She bumped her case up the steps and waited as the porter dealt with the boy in front of her, or rather, with his parents. The boy's mother had a lot of questions about Wi-Fi access and shower arrangements, but at last they were done, and Hannah found herself standing at the counter, wishing her own mother would hurry up and park the car. She felt she could use the backup. "Hi," she said. Her stomach was fluttering with nerves, but she tried to keep her voice steady. She was an adult now, a Pelham College student. She was here by right, and nothing to feel nervous about. "My name is Hannah. Hannah Jones. Can you tell me where I should go?"
"Hannah Jones."
The porter was a round, jocular-looking man with a fluffy white beard and the air of an off-duty Father Christmas. He perched a set of spectacles on his nose and began peering down a long printed list of names.
"Hannah Jones, Hannah Jones. Ah, yes, here we are. You're in New Quad Staircase 7, Room 5. That's a set, that is. Very nice."
A set? Hannah wasn't sure if she was supposed to know what that meant, but the porter was still talking, and her opportunity for asking had passed.
"Now, you'll want to head through that arch there."
He pointed through the mullioned window at a tall arch on the other side of the square of velvety grass.
"Turn left through the fellow's garden. Mind you, don't tread on the grass. Past the master's lodgings and staircase 7 is the opposite side of New Quad. Here's a map. Free of charge for you, my dear."
He slapped a shiny folded leaflet onto the wooden countertop. "Thanks," Hannah said. She picked up the plan, put it into her jeans pocket, and then remembered, "Oh, my mother might turn up soon. She had to park the car. Could you tell her where I've gone if she comes in here?"
"Hannah Jones's mum," the man said ruminatively. "That I can do. John," he called over his shoulder to a man sorting post behind him, "if I'm on my lunch, if Hannah Jones's mum comes, She's in 7-5 New Quad.
Right you are,
the man standing behind him said. Then he turned and looked at Hannah. He was a big man, probably 6 foot, and younger than his colleague, with dark hair and a face that looked both pale and sweaty, even though he wasn't doing anything remotely physical. His voice was oddly out of proportion with the rest of him, high and reedy, and the contrast made Hannah want to laugh nervously.
Well, thanks, she said, and turned to go.
She was almost at the door when the second man called after her, his voice abrupt and slightly accusatory.
Hold your horses, young lady.
Hannah turned back, feeling her heart quicken as if she'd done something wrong. The man came out from behind the counter, moving ponderously, and then stopped in front of her. There was something in his hand, and now he held it out to her, dangling whatever it was like a trophy. It was a set of keys.
Oh!
Hannah felt foolish. She gave a short laugh.
Thanks!
She held out her hand, but for a moment the man didn't let go. He just stood there, the keys dangling above her palm. Then he opened his grip and let them fall, and she shoved them into her pocket and turned away.
V-I-I,
said the writing painted above the stairwell, and Hannah, looking down at the plan in her hand and then up at the stone steps in front of her, had to assume this was the right place. She cast a glance over her shoulder, not so much because she doubted the map, but more for the pleasure of taking it all in. The pristine green square of manicured lawn, the honey-coloured stone, the mullioned windows. With the sun shining and puffs of white autumnal clouds in the sky, the view had an almost unreal beauty. And Hannah had the strangest feeling that she had stepped inside the pages of one of the books in her suitcase. Brideshead Revisited, maybe. Gaudy Night, his dark materials. A storybook world. She was smiling as she pulled her case beneath the archway into Staircase 7. But bumping the case up the stairs wasn't easy, and her smile had faded by the first landing. By the time she reached the second, she was hot, breathless, and the fairy tale feeling was wearing off fast.
4. H. Clayton,
read a neat little notice on the left-hand door, and opposite, 3. P. Burns Wallace. The middle door was ajar, and as Hannah stood there catching her breath, it opened to reveal a very small kitchen containing 2 boys, one bent over an electric hob, the other holding a cup of tea and staring at her with an expression that was probably only curious, but came across more than a little hostile.
Hi,
Hannah said, rather diffidently. But the boy only gave her a nod and edged past the door marked P. Burns Wallace. What had the porter said? Room 5? One more floor still to go, then. Gritting her teeth, Hannah yanked her case up the last flight onto the top floor, where 2 doors stood opposite each other, one ajar. 6. Dr. Myers, said the one to her right, which was shut. The open one was, by process of elimination, presumably her own, and Hannah stepped inside.
Hey!
The girl sprawled across the sofa barely looked up from her phone as Hannah entered. She was wearing a short broderie anglaise dress that revealed long tanned legs hooked over the arm of the couch, one sandal hanging from pedicured toes. She appeared to be scrolling through some kind of photo app on her phone.
You must be Hannah.
I am?
Hannah said uncertainly, her voice rising at the end of the sentence in a way that made her words sound like a question, even though they weren't. She looked around the room. It seemed to be a sitting room, but with piles of the fanciest luggage Hannah had ever seen stacked up by the doorway. There were hat boxes, hanging bags, a huge Selfridges tote filled with velvet cushions, and what looked like a real Louis Vuitton trunk with a giant brass lock. The pile dwarfed her own modest luggage, even when you took into account the suitcase her mother would be bringing up from the car.
Who are you?
April. The girl put down her phone and stood up. She was middle height and slim, with cropped honey blonde hair that hugged the shape of her skull and finely arched eyebrows that gave her a look somewhere between amusement and disdain. There was something otherworldly about her, some indefinable quality Hannah could not put her finger on. She felt almost as if she had seen her somewhere before, or watched her in a film. She had the kind of beauty that hurt your eyes if you looked at her for too long, but made it hard to tear your gaze away. It was, Hannah realized, as if a different kind of light were shining on her than on the rest of the room.
April Clark Cliveden, the girl added helpfully, when Hannah did not immediately reply, as if that name should mean something.
But I thought, Hannah said, and then broke off, turning uncertainly back to the door to check the name tag. Sure enough, there it was. 5 H. Jones, and then, below that, A. Clark Cliveden. Hannah frowned.
Are we roommates?
It seemed unlikely. One of the points stressed in the Pelham College brochure had been the fact that there was virtually no shared accommodation, no double rooms, not even any flats until the second year. A lot of shared bathrooms, sure, unless you were in the modern wing, but as far as sleeping went, the prospectus had made it sound like everyone had their own space.
Kinda, April said. She gave a yawn like a cat and stretched luxuriantly. I mean, not a bedroom. There's no way I'd have accepted that. Just a sitting room.
She waved her hand around the modest space, making Hannah feel like she, April, was the gracious hostess and Hannah the interloper. The thought gave Hannah a prickle of annoyance, but she pushed it down and looked around the room. Aside from April's stack of luggage, the furnishings were sparse and institutional. A rather worn sofa, a coffee table and a sideboard. But it was clean and bright, with a beautiful stone fireplace.
Nice to have somewhere to hang out, right? Your room's through there.
She nodded at a door to the right of the window.
Mine's the door opposite. I'm afraid I picked the bigger one. First come, first served, and all that.
She gave a wink that showed a deep, soft dimple in one cheek. Fair enough, Hannah said. There was no point in arguing the fact. By the looks of it, the girl had already unpacked. Instead, she lugged her suitcase across the rug, the wheels rucking it into ridges, towards the door April had indicated. After April's remarks, she was expecting something small, pokey even, but it was larger than her room at home, with another carved stone fireplace and a mullioned window with leaded glass casting diamond-patterned light onto the polished oak boards.
Wow, this is pretty cool, she said, and then wanted to kick herself for sounding so transparently impressed in the face of April's sophistication. Still, she could admit it privately to herself. It was pretty cool. How many students had this room seen over the 400 years since it was built? Had they gone on to be peers and politicians, Nobel Prize winners and authors? It was dizzying, like looking down the wrong end of a telescope, only instead of looking outwards at the end of the line, she could see herself, infinitely small.
"Yeah, it's okay, isn't it?" April said.
She came and stood in the doorway, one hand against the door jamb, the other resting on her jutting hip. With the low evening light streaming through the thin material of her white dress, silhouetting her shape and turning her pixie hair into a white halo, she looked like an image off a film poster. "What's yours like?" Hannah asked, and April shrugged.
"Pretty similar. Want to come and have a look?"
"Sure." Hannah set down her case and followed April across the living room to the opposite door. Inside, her first impression was that it was not pretty similar at all. Aside from the fact that it was slightly larger, the only things that were the same were the metal bedstead and the fireplace. Every other stick of furniture was different, from the Kilim rugs to the fancy ergonomic desk chair to the richly upholstered love seat in the corner. A tall, burly man in a suit was unpacking clothes into a tall wardrobe. He didn't look up as they entered. "Hi," Hannah said politely. She put on her best meet the parents voice. "You must be April's dad. I'm Hannah." April gave a shout of laughter at that.
"You must be kidding. This is Harry. He works for my parents."
"Pleased to meet you," the man said over his shoulder.
Then he slid the last drawer shut and turned around.
"I think that's it, April. Anything else I can help you with?"
"No, that's fine. Thank you, Harry."
"I'll take the boxes. Want me to leave the trunk?"
"No, don't worry. I won't have anywhere to store it."
"Sure,"
Harry said.
"Have fun. There's a little goodbye present from your dad on the windowsill. Nice to meet you, Hannah,"
he said, then turned, picked up a pile of empty bags and boxes by the door, and left. The door swung shut, and April kicked off her shoes and threw herself onto the newly made bed, sinking deep into the soft feathered duvet.
"So this is it. Real life."
"Real life," Hannah echoed. It wasn't true, though. Sitting here in a centuries-old centre of learning surrounded by April's rich, beautiful things, breathing in the strange heavy scent of some expensive perfume, she had never felt more unreal. She wondered what her mum, presumably still circling Oxford looking for a parking space, would make of all this.
"Better see what he's left me, I guess," April said. "The box isn't Tiffany's, which is a bad start."
She swung her legs off the bed and went to the window, where a tall gift box stood on the stone sill. A card was poking out of a gap at the top of the box.
"Start your Oxford life the right way. Love, Daddy." Well, he signed it himself, at least. One up from my birthday card, which was in his secretary's writing.
Digging her nails into the lid, she pried it open and then began to laugh.
"Oh, God! Just when I think he barely knows my middle name, he proves me wrong."
She held up a bottle of champagne and two glasses.
"Drink, Hannah Jones."
Sure, Hannah said. In truth, she didn't really like champagne. The few times she'd had it, at weddings and her mum's 50th, it had given her a headache. But there was no way she was going to refuse such a perfect moment. Maybe Dodsworth Hannah didn't like champagne, but Pelham College Hannah was different. She watched as April popped the cork with a practiced expertise and poured out two foaming glasses.
"Well, it's not chilled, but it's Dom Pérignon, at least," April said, handing over a flute. "What shall we drink to? How about..."
"To Oxford," she held out her glass. "To Oxford," Hannah echoed. She clinked her glass against April's and then put it to her lips. The warm, fizzing champagne frothed in her mouth, the bubbles expanding on her tongue, and the alcohol tickling at the back of her nose and throat. She began to feel a little light-headed, though whether that was the champagne or the fact that they had driven through lunch or just this, she could not have said. "And to Pelham."
"And to us," April said.
She threw back her head and drained the glass in four long gulps. Then she refilled, looked at Hannah, and smiled. A wide, wicked smile that shot that deep, beguiling dimple into each soft cheek.
"Yes, here's to us, Hannah Jones. I think we're going to have a pretty majestic time here, don't you?"
After. As Hannah puts the phone down, she feels the quiet of the shop close around her like a cocoon. She would never tell Kathy, but these times are the reason she came to work at Tall Tales. Not the Saturday hustle and bustle of customers or the August rush of tourists for the festival, but the quiet midweek lulls when she is not alone exactly, for you're never alone in a room filled with 1,000 books, but when she is alone with the books. Christie, the Brontes, Sayers, Mitford, Dickens. These are the people who got her through the years after April's death. She escaped the stares and sympathy of real life, the terrifying unpredictability of the internet, the horrors of a reality where you could be ambushed at any moment by a reporter or a curious stranger or by the death of your best friend, into a world where everything was ordered. In books, a bad thing might happen on page 207, that was true, but it would always happen on page 207, no matter what. And when you reread, you could see it coming. Watch out for the signs. Prepare yourself. Now, she listens to the gentle spatter of the Edinburgh rain on the bow window at her back, the tick, tick of old floorboards creaking as the heating pipes come on. She feels the silent sympathy of the books. For a moment, she has a visceral longing to pick up one of them, an old favourite perhaps, a novel she knows practically by heart, and sink into the pile of beanbags in the children's section, shutting out the world. But she can't. She is on duty. And besides, she's not alone, not really. She can see Robin now, edging her way back through the maze of little Victorian rooms that make up Tall Tales, each crowded with display tables and dump bins.
"Beep, beep! Robin Grant, Tea Lady Extraordinaire coming through," she says as she enters the front of the bookshop.
She plonks the two cups cheerfully down on the counter, slopping hot brown liquid dangerously close to the card display.
"The one with the spoon is yours. Are you..."
She looks over at Hannah and then stops, taken aback by something in Hannah's expression.
"Hey, are you okay? You look really odd.
Hannah's heart sinks. Is it that obvious?
I'm not sure, she says slowly. I've had some weird news.
Oh, my God. Robin's hand goes to her throat and her eyes flick involuntarily to Hannah's stomach and then back up to her face.
No,
Hannah says quickly. She tries to smile, though it feels false and stiff.
Nothing like that. It's just family stuff.
It's the closest she could come to the truth on the spur of the moment. But she wishes, as soon as the final words leave her mouth, that she had not chosen them. John Neville is not family. She doesn't want him or his memory anywhere near her family.
Do you need to go?
Robin says. She looks at her watch and then at the empty shop.
It's nearly five. I doubt we'll get a rush now. I can handle anything that comes up.
No, Hannah says reflexively. She shouldn't need to leave. After all, what's really changed?
Nothing.
But at the same time, the thought of trying to stand here smiling at customers like nothing has happened, with the memories boiling and churning inside her.
Go, Robin says, making up her mind. Honestly, just go. I'll explain to Kathy if she comes in, but she won't mind.
Really? Hannah asks, and Robin nods firmly. Hannah stands up, picks up her phone, feeling a rush of guilt and gratitude. She finds Robin irritating sometimes, her relentless girl-guidish cheerfulness, her habit of telling customers,
"No, you have a great day,"
over and over again. But now there's something immensely comforting about her solid, unflappable kindness. Thank you so much, Robin. I'll return the favour, I promise.
Hey, no thanks needed,
Robin says. She smiles, pats Hannah on her arm, but Hannah can see the concern in her eyes beneath the friendly smile. And she feels Robin's gaze on her as she walks slowly back to the staff room to gather up her things. When she leaves the shop, the rain has stopped, and it's a damp, clear autumn afternoon, so like the day she first turned up at Pelham that for an instant the links to the past feel almost sickeningly real. As she stops at the traffic light, waiting for the green man, she has the strangest sensation that at any moment she might see April walking casually through the crowd, that lazy, mocking smile on her lips and the deep dimples coming and going in her cheeks. For a second, Hannah has to steady herself on a lamppost. The past is so real, so close. She feels an unassuageable yearning for it to be true. For that tall, blonde girl hurrying through the crowd with the light behind her to be April. Brilliant. Beautiful. Alive. How would she greet her? Would she hug her? Slap her? Cry? Hannah does not know. Maybe all of them. She is heading through the crowds of tourists towards the bus stop for her usual number 24 back to Stockbridge, eager to get home in time to get supper on, put up her increasingly weary feet, watch some trashy TV. But as she nears the stand and her pace doesn't slow, she realises that she is not going to stop, that the thought of spending 20 minutes trapped in a stuffy bus in the halting city traffic appalls her. She needs to walk. Only the pavement beneath her feet will help her pace off this sense of unease. order her thoughts before she has to face Will. And besides, what is there for her at home except an empty flat and a waiting laptop with all the sickly, glittering allure of the Google searches she knows she will perform as soon as she's back? For now, though, she'll allow herself just one, just to make it real, in the same way she didn't quite believe the child in her belly was real until she saw the images on the screen, heard the strange subterranean whoosh and echo of its heart. In the shadow of the castle, she stops in a doorway and pulls out her phone. Then she opens up an incognito browser tab and types the words into Google, John Neville, BBC News. She doesn't need the last part, but she's learned not to put anything as unfettered as just his name into search engines. The sites that come up are full of gross images. Wild speculation, defamatory statements about her and Will that she has neither the time nor the resources to fight. At least the BBC can be relied upon to stick mainly to the facts. And there it is, the top result. Breaking. Pelham College killer John Neville dies in prison. The shock is like ice water on her skin. But she steels herself and clicks through. John Neville, better known as the Pelham Strangler, has died in prison aged 63, prison authorities confirmed earlier today. Neville, who was convicted in 2012 of the killing of college student April Clark Cliveden, died in the early hours of this morning. A prison spokesperson said that he had suffered a massive heart attack and was pronounced dead on arrival at Mersey Hospital. Neville's lawyer, Clive Merritt, said that his client was in the process of preparing a fresh appeal when he died. He went to his grave protesting his innocence, Merritt told the BBC. It's a huge injustice that his chance of overturning his conviction dies with him. The Clark Cliveden family were unavailable for comment. Hannah's hands are trembling. It's been so long since she voluntarily sought out news of Neville that she'd forgotten how it feels to be confronted with his name, with the memories of April, and worst of all, with their pictures. There are only a few shots out there of Neville. The one used most is his college ID, a glowering image like a police mugshot, where he stares uncompromisingly out of the screen at the viewer, his gaze discomfortingly direct. Seeing his face is enough of a jolt, but the pieces Hannah really hates are the ones that focus on April. Lissome social media snaps of her sprawled in punts, draped over other students, their faces pixelated to protect a privacy long since ripped away from her. Worst of all are the shots of her dead body. Those pictures aren't supposed to be out there, but of course they are. You can find anything on the internet. And before Hannah learned to stop searching, long before she figured out how to use incognito tabs, Google's algorithm identified her as someone with an interest in the Pelham Strangler, offering up clickbait articles on the subject with a sickening regularity. "Is this helpful?" her phone would ask, and after she had clicked not interested enough times, stabbing the screen with such force that her shaking fingers felt the shock of impact long after she had put the phone away. Eventually it got the message and stopped showing her the links. But even now, occasionally one will slip through, prompted by some inscrutable inner quirk deep in the workings of Google's news algorithm, and she will open up her phone to see April smiling out at her with that clear, direct gaze that still stabs her to the heart, even 10 years on. And every now and again, someone will track her down, and an email will ping unsolicited into her inbox. "Are you the Hannah Jones who was involved with the April Clark Cliveden murder? I'm writing a piece, a college essay, a psychological profile, an article on John Neville's appeal." At first, she replied, angrily, using words like morbid and vulture. Then, when she'd learned that only made them keep trying or include her furious emails in their article as attributed quotes, she changed tack. "No, my name is Hannah de Chastain. I can't help you." But that was a mistake too. It wasn't just that it felt like a betrayal of April. For the researchers to have got this far, to have tracked down her email address, they knew. They knew who Will was, and they knew who she was, and the fact that she had taken Will's name on marriage did nothing to obscure her tracks. "Why don't you just ignore them?" Will asked, baffled, when she told him about them. "That's what I do." And of course he was right. Now she simply doesn't reply. But still, she can't quite bring herself to delete them. So they sit there in a special folder buried deep at the bottom of her inbox. It's titled Requests. Just that. And one day, she keeps promising herself, one day when it's all over, she will erase the whole lot. But somehow, that day has never quite come. Now she's wondering if it ever will. She is about to shut down the screen when she looks for the first time at the photograph accompanying the article. It's not one of April. It's Neville. But it's a shot she's never seen before. Not the hatchet-faced ID card she knows so well, nor the snatched paparazzi snap of him sticking two fingers up at reporters outside court. No, this one must have been taken much later, at one of his many appeals, probably quite a recent one. He looks old, and more than that, he looks frail. He has lost weight, and although it's not possible that he's lost height, he looks so far removed from the towering figure Hannah remembers that it's hard to believe they are the same person. He's dressed in a prison uniform that seems to hang off his gaunt frame, and he is staring at the camera with a haunted, hunted expression that seems to suck the viewer into his nightmare.
"Excuse me." The terse voice comes from behind her, and she jumps, realizing that she has ground to a halt in the middle of King's Stables underpass, and a woman is trying to get past.
Sorry, she stammers, shutting down the phone with hands that aren't quite steady, and shoving it into her pocket as though it has been contaminated by the image on the screen. "Sorry." The woman pushes past with a shake of her head, and Hannah starts for home. But even as she comes out of the dark underpass into the autumn sunlight, she can still feel it. Still feel his eyes upon her, that dark, hunted gaze, like he is beseeching her for something. She just doesn't know what. It's quite dark by the time Hannah finally turns into Stockbridge Mews. Her feet sore with walking, and she has to search in her handbag for the keys, cursing the fact that no one has replaced the burned-out bulb above the shared front door.
But at last she is inside, up the stairs, and the door of their flat is closed behind her. For a long time, she just stands there, her back against the door, feeling the silence of the flat all around her. She is home before Will, and she's glad of this moment to just stand there in the cool, quiet welcome of their little flat, letting it wash over her. She should put on the kettle, take off her shoes, turn on the lights, but she does none of these things. Instead, she just goes through to the living room, slumps into an armchair, and sits, trying to come to terms with what has just happened. She is still sitting there when she hears Will's bike draw up outside, its throaty roar reverberating off the other houses in the narrow mews. He kills the engine, and a few moments later she hears his key in the downstairs lock and the noise of him coming up the stairs. As he opens the front door, she knows she should get up, say something, but she can't. She just doesn't have the energy. She hears him dump his bag in the hallway stand, come down the corridor, hissing some silly pop song between his teeth, flick on the lights, and then stop. Hannah? He's standing in front of her, blinking, trying to make sense of her being here, alone, in the dark.
Han, what are you... Is everything okay?
Hannah swallows, trying to find the words, but the only one that comes out is a cracked...
No.
Will's face changes at that. He falls to his knees in front of her, his face suddenly frightened, his hands on hers, holding her.
Han, it's not... It isn't... Has something happened? Is it the baby?
No. It comes quickly this time, as she suddenly understands his concern.
Oh, my God, no. Nothing like that.
She swallows, forcing out the words.
Will? It's John Neville. He's dead.
It's unintentionally brutal. Harsher even than the way her mother told her, but she's too shaken and broken to figure out a better way of conveying the news. Will says nothing, but he lets his hands drop, and his face for a second goes unguardedly, heartbreakingly vulnerable, before he closes in on himself. He stands, moves over to the bay window, and leans against the shutters, looking out into the darkness of the mews. She can see his face only in profile, pale against his dark hair and the blackness of the glass behind him. She's always found him hard to read in moments like this. He's generous with his joys, but when he's in pain or afraid, he holds his emotions close to his chest, as if he can't bear being seen to be hurting. A legacy, she supposes, of a military father and a boarding education at a school where showing emotion was for sissies and crybabies. If it weren't for that split second when he let his defences drop, she would have thought he hadn't heard what she said. Now, she's not sure what's going on underneath his silence, behind the polite, neutral mask of his face.
Will,
she says at last, say something. He turns and looks at her, as if he has been very far away.
Good.
It's just that one word, but there's a brutality in his voice that she's never heard before, and it shocks her.
Now, he says, what's for supper?
Before.
Oh, my God.
April's voice was theatrically drawling, more than a touch of Janice from Friends, Hannah thought, as she followed her down the narrow passage between the long dining tables that ran the length of the hall. It was the first time Hannah had set foot in the Great Hall as an actual Pelham student, and she felt a prickle of wonder as she looked around her at the ancient beams soaring high overhead and the dark oak-panelled walls dotted with oil paintings of former masters. She might have felt overwhelmed by it all, but it was hard to feel intimidated with April beside her, bitching about the limited menu and poor acoustics. Now April set down her tray on one of the long, crowded refectory tables and put her hands on her hips.
"Will de Chastain, as I live and breathe."
One of the students sitting at the long oak bench turned, his dark hair falling in his eyes, and Hannah found her heart missing a beat. The glass of water on her dinner tray slid an inch to the left, and she hastily righted it.
"April!"
He stood up, swinging one long leg easily over the bench, and the two embraced in a sort of part hug, part continental kiss that was so deeply un-Dodsworth that Hannah felt more than ever as if she had landed on another planet.
"Good to see you. I had no idea you were coming here."
"Well, that's Liv for you. Doesn't tell people anything. How is she? I haven't seen her since exams."
"Oh."
The boy's tanned face suddenly flushed, a streak of colour high on his cheekbones.
We broke up. My fault, if I'm being honest. Sorry."
"Don't apologise," April purred.
She ran a hand down the boy's arm, squeezing his biceps in a way that was just the right side of teasing.
"Another eligible man on the scene is nothing to be sorry about."
Behind her, Hannah shifted. The tray she was holding was becoming uncomfortably heavy, and her arms were starting to ache. April must have heard the movement because she turned and gave a slightly theatrical double take, seeming to remember Hannah's presence for the first time since she'd spoken to Will.
"God, where are my manners? Will, this is Hannah Jones, my roommate. She's studying English. We've got a suite, don't you know? So I've got a feeling we'll be hosting all the parties this term. Hannah, this is Will de Chastain. I went to school with his ex. Our boarding schools were... what would you call it?"
She turned back to Will.
"Twin?"
"Something like that."
A smile crinkled the tanned skin at the side of Will's mouth. Hannah found herself staring up at him. He had clear brown eyes, dark brows, and his nose had clearly been broken maybe more than once. Hannah's mouth felt dry, and she swallowed, trying to think what to say, but Will filled in the silence for her.
"I went to Khan, all boys, so they paired us up for socials with April School to try to ensure we didn't get to uni without having met a real live female."
"No danger of that with you, darling," April said.
She took a swig of the chocolate milk on her tray and then slid onto the bench beside Will without bothering to ask if she could. Will sat back down beside her.
"I was actually saving that seat, you know,"
he said to April, but conversationally, not as if he expected her to move. Hannah, still standing, hesitated. There was a space opposite, but only one. Maybe Will wanted it for his missing friend. She looked at April, seeking a cue, but April was tapping away on her phone. Hannah bit her lip, half turned away, and then Will spoke.
"Hey, don't go. We'll make room."
Her heart flipped again. She smiled, trying not to look too pathetically grateful as Will put his bag on the floor and nudged his neighbour up a few inches, making an extra space.
"Look, sit there."
He indicated the space opposite.
"Hugh can squeeze in next to me in April."
"Did you say Hugh?"
April's head came up from her phone at that. There was an odd expression on her face. Surprise, even delight, but mixed with a kind of mischievousness that Hannah couldn't totally figure out.
"Not Hugh Bland?"
"The very same. Didn't you know he was applying here?"
"I knew he was trying for Oxford, but I had no idea he'd picked Pelham," April said.
She put her phone down, and then a smile curved her lips as a tall, pale boy with heavy Stephen Hawking-style glasses came up to the table.
"Well, well, well. Speak of the devil."
"April," the boy said, and then all at once he stumbled, tripping over his own feet so that his tray lurched out of his hands, the pasta crashing to the floor.
There was a moment's dead silence. Every head in the place turned, and then one of the other boys at the table spoke up.
"Hey, up. Show's over, everyone. Move along now."
Hugh, though clearly mortified, laughed and gave a little self-conscious bow. His face was scarlet as he picked up his can of Coke and scooped up stray tortellini.
"Sorry, such an ass."
His voice was muffled, but plainly what Hannah's classmates would have called classic posh boy.
"So sorry. Thank God it landed right way up, mostly."
He slid into the seat beside Will with the ruined plate of pasta, his cheeks still flaming, and picked up a fork.
"Don't eat that, you idiot," April said, a little scornfully.
She stood, waving her arm at the counter.
"Hey, could we get some help over here? And another plate of the tortellini?"
They all watched in silence as a member of the catering staff came across with a spare plate and a cloth to wipe up the spilled sauce.
"I'm so sorry,"
Hugh said again, this time to the caterer, who just nodded and walked off. Hugh looked miserable, and Hannah suddenly felt unbearably sorry for him.
"Do you all know each other?"
she said to April and Will, more in an attempt to change the subject than because she was in doubt. April nodded, smiling, but it was Will who answered.
"Hugh and I go way back. We were at prep school together. And there's nothing that binds friends like a shit prep school. Right, Hugh?"
"Right,"
Hugh said.
The flush was fading from his cheeks, and he had his head down, bent over his food as if he was trying to avoid everyone's gaze.
"Hugh Bland," he said to Hannah. "Medicine."
"Hugh and I are very good friends,"
April said, with a kind of purr. She reached across and pinched Hugh's cheek, and the scarlet tide rose in his face again, this time reaching to his ears. There was a brittle silence.
"And what about you?"
April said, with the air of breaking an awkward moment. She was speaking to the boy sitting next to Hannah, the one who had told everyone the show was over. He was a broad, stocky kid with Mediterranean colouring, wearing a Sheffield Wednesday football shirt.
"This is Ryan Coates," Will said. "He's doing PPE, same as me."
"All right,"
Ryan said, grinning. His accent was straight up Sheffield, and after so many posh southern voices, it sounded almost aggressively northern. Hannah felt a sudden shock of kinship, even though Dodsworth was about as far south as it was possible to get. But here was someone normal, like her, someone not from the moneyed private school background that Will and April seemed to take for granted.
"We're all on the same floor in Clodes," Will said.
Clodes, Hannah knew from the prospectus, was the big modern wing at the back of the new quad, where most of the first years had ended up. It was square and made of brutalist concrete, but the rooms were en suite and the heating actually worked. Still, Hannah couldn't help feeling secretly grateful that she and April had been allocated a picturesque old-style room. After all, wasn't this what she had come to Oxford for? She had wanted to walk in the footsteps of 400 years of scholars, not on the carpet squares of the last few decades.
"Heard him playing the Stone Roses through the wall,"
Ryan pointed his fork at Will.
"Went over to introduce myself and it turned out we're on the same course. Andy introduced me to this bloke."
He nodded at Hugh.
"Will and I were at school together," Hugh said, and then flushed again.
"Oh, wait. Duh, Will already told you that, sorry. Such a thicko."
"Don't listen to him," Will said with an affectionate dig in his friend's ribs. "Hugh was the brainiest chap in our year." Ryan spoke around a tortellini, his expression rather droll.
"Well, isn't that the coincidence? I was the brainiest chap in my year. Looks like you and me have something in common."
"We were all the brainiest in our year," said the girl next to Ryan, speaking for the first time.
Her voice was deep and rather brusque and impatient.
"Isn't that the point? Isn't that why we're here?"
"And who are you?"
Ryan said, looking her up and down. She had long, dark hair, a serious, slightly equine face, black rectangular glasses, and she looked Ryan straight back in the eye with none of the diffidence Hannah would have felt at being appraised so baldly.
"Emily Lipman." The girl put a forkful of pasta in her mouth, chewed deliberately, and then swallowed. "Mathematics. You can call me Emily Lipman."
"I like you, Emily Lipman,"
Ryan said with a broad grin, and Emily raised a single eyebrow.
"To which I'm supposed to say..."
"Whatever you like," Ryan said. "Nothing if you want."
He was still grinning. Emily rolled her eyes.
"Anyway," April said lazily, "it's not true."
"What's not true?"
Hugh asked.
"About being the cleverest in our year. I wasn't."
"How did you get in here then?"
Emily said. The remark should have sounded rude, but somehow coming from her, it didn't, just preternaturally direct.
"My natural charm, I suppose," April said. And she smiled, the deep, soft dimples showing in her golden cheeks. "Or maybe my dad's money."
There was a long silence, as if no one knew quite how to take this. Then Ryan gave a short, barking laugh, as if April had told a joke.
"Well, good for you," Emily said, "on both counts."
She shoved the last forkful of pasta into her mouth and stood up, brushing herself down.
"Now, what the fuck does a woman have to do to get a drink around here?"
"We could go to that common room place,"
Ryan said. He stood too. Hannah saw that he was much taller than she had realised.
"What did they call it, the JCB?
"JCR," April said.
Her lips curled in a smile that Hannah was beginning to recognise as quintessentially April, beguiling and, at the same time, just a little bit wicked.
"Junior Common Room, if you read the handbook, which you clearly didn't, and there's also a bar next to the Great Hall. But sod that, we're hardly commoners, and who needs a bar when you've got a totally majestic suite and a fridge full of champagne?"
She pushed her still full plate of tortellini away, looked around the group of faces, and then pulled a room key out of her pocket, dangling it from one finger as she raised a fine, dark eyebrow.
"Am I right?"